full Friday afternoon in Johannesburg. You're with Talk Central, the business technology podcast brought to you by the editors at techcentral.co.za. My name is Duncan McLeod. I'm here with Craig Wilson. How's it, Craig?
Good, thanks. And you, Duncan?
Another holiday interrupted week, the last for a while.
Yeah, but the bonus is quiet roads.
Quiet roads today. Yeah, I went into Sandton this morning and I couldn't believe it. It was like a ghost town.
It's been wonderful.
Yeah, it's great. Not great for website traffic, but it's great to catch up on admin and...
Small comfort for those of us who are still in the office today, yeah.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. So did you get a chance to see the lunar eclipse on Wednesday night?
I did, yeah, from someone's garden. But that was the problem, was we kept running in and out to check it because it was so cold.
Okay. Oh, no, just freezing. We were out at Marapeng, the cradle of humankind. And that was absolutely stunning, but absolutely freezing as well. Unfortunately, I left my tripod at home, so I couldn't really get any good pictures of it.
I did exactly the same thing. We went to a friend's house, and I couldn't be bothered to go home and get the tripod again, so yes. I just did without.
Yes. Okay, cool. Well, let's get on to tech news. The big news was Monday this week, really, with Telkom's results presentation. There was a lot flowing out of that.
Sure.
It certainly kept us busy the whole day.
Yes.
But, yeah, some of the big takeouts out of that, I thought... interesting one was the ATA subscriber numbers, their mobile network. 1.2 million people have gone through the SIM card registration process and signed up for the service, but they only have 470,000 active customers right now, which suggests the churn rate is quite high.
Sure, I mean, the churn rate's enormous and a disappointing figure for ATA. You know, to 1.2 million sounds far better, and it was figures like that that we were hearing bandied about before the 400,000 was confirmed.
Yes.
And, well, I say 400,000, that's doing them a disservice. It's closer to the 500,000 mark, but still.
Let's call it 500,000, yeah. I'm sure they're probably past 500,000 because, of course, these numbers are for the end of March this year. But, yeah, it's... ATA's got a big presentation at Telkom's data center in Centurion on Monday, so we'll be covering that in some detail. Hopefully we'll get some more insight into what their plans are to gain more market share in this market. I spoke to Pinky Moholi, the Telkom CEO, and she said that they are on track to sign up 15% of the market over a period, I think she said, of 5 years. I stand to correction there, but that is still in a very aggressive target. 470,000 subscribers probably gives them around 1.5 or 2% of the total right now.
Sure. It is aggressive, but also Telkom, I suppose Telkom have the power of their existing products and client base to leverage. And particularly if they keep coming out with contracts that offer sort of tantalizing options for existing Telkom users, particularly, you know, families with a landline and so on.
You took a look at this new Telkom Mix service, which is launching later this month.
Which is a very peculiar first outing, though, Duncan, because what they're offering is rather, you know, one would expect if you're going to offer a converged product, well, you would think that the most common would be a cell phone or a mobile plan and an ADSL line. But this particular first product coming out relates to a BlackBerry and a fixed line.
Yes.
And while there may be benefits to actually calling that fixed line through your ATA BlackBerry and so on, and obviously you get the BlackBerry internet services, it just seems a peculiar option to bundle something like a BlackBerry with something like a fixed line service. You know, one of the things that came out of the report on Monday too from Telkom was the number of people they're seeing who are signing up for a line exclusively for the purposes of ADSL.
Yeah.
Actually aren't generating any voice business for them. And so I think it's, you know, there's a real opportunity for Telkom to leverage their current influence by putting out some sort of clever converged products. And I think ones that include data and a cell phone plan will make a lot more sense. But it's certainly a step in the right direction. And if they can leverage this well, then perhaps their objective isn't quite as optimistic as I think the rest of us think it is at the moment.
Well, one assumes that there will be other Telkom Mix products coming down the line, and presumably there will be one which offers ADSL only.
Sure, I mean there has to be. It just seems so peculiar to start with one that doesn't.
Yes.
Particularly if you know, as your first product, that's the first foray into the market and the one that people are going to, you know, make first impressions on.
Yes.
It just seems a peculiar choice.
Yes. Yes. The other news that came out of Telkom this week was that the Multilinks disaster continues unabated.
Yes.
They've announced that they're no longer going to be selling Multilinks to VisaPhone because of this lawsuit that was brought by Helios Towers, which is a tower management company which Multilinks had entered a 10-year agreement into. Helios Towers is suing them for $250 million for breach of contract, and in Nigerian High Court this week, or last week rather, found in Helios Towers' favor, which has prevented Telkom from selling Multilinks to Visa phones. So now they've announced that they're simply going to stop funding Multilinks.
Sure, and one gets the impression that eventually they're just going to call it quits entirely and cut their losses.
I get the impression that that's what they're going to do. I think Multilinks is going to be liquidated.
Sure, or cut, in this case, their sizable losses. Because it's really just been a black hole.
Yeah, it's been a disaster. I mean, the original investment was done by Papi Molotsane, a former Telkom CEO who was subsequently fired. And then I think Ruben September, his successor, bought another 25%. Goodness knows why. In the company, perhaps they wanted absolute control over it because they thought they could somehow rescue it.
But, sure.
But no, it's been an absolute disaster. And they, I saw one of the, I think it was Reuters or Bloomberg's, one of the wire services this week, confirmed that Telkom has pumped almost 10 billion rand into this black hole, both through write-downs and through actual investment in infrastructure and the acquisition. But it's certainly one of the biggest corporate catastrophes in South African business history.
Sure, sure. And unfortunately, those costs, at least to some extent, are going to continue. Because Telkom hasn't as yet said that they are going to call it quits and that they are going to cut their losses and run. So at the moment, that leak's going to continue, but clearly that they're at least planning to tie it up. And
I mean, I don't know what you thought, Craig, but I thought that Telkom were quite honest in the big challenges that they're facing. They seem to be really owning up for the first time to the fact that the good time is over, and they really actually have to pull a rabbit out of the hat now, effectively to keep this company on the straight and narrow. They really are facing a lot of challenges, not just in Nigeria but here in South Africa as well, where competition is seriously intensifying.
Absolutely, and I think I agree with you. I think they were very they've been very sort of down the line about it. And it felt like an honest presentation on Monday.
And it did.
And like an acceptance, for a long time, I think people have felt like Telkom have abused, the sort of monopolistic position they were put into. And now that with competition coming up, there was the sense that they were saying, well, we've been, we rested on our laurels and now we're paying for it. And we realize we've got to make big changes or we're going to be in big trouble.
I like Pinky Moholi, Nomalelo Moholi, the CEO. She's... I think she's got her head screwed on right, and we had a conversation with her where we sort of spoke a bit about the political issues inside Telkom, which have been a huge challenge for them in recent years, with executives fighting with each other and political intrigue, which the organization can ill afford, especially in a competitive market where it's supposed to be focusing on building a company that can survive and thrive in this competitive environment. And the last thing it can afford is for its management team to be bogged down in political infighting. But she seems to have made that one of her top priorities, and I guess time will tell. But if they can get that right and start to actually focus on the real pressing issues at hand, then maybe Telkom is going to turn the corner.
Sure, we can only hope.
Yeah. Interesting comment she made at the results presentation was that she felt that the time had come for ICASA, the regulator, to do away with the retail price controls on Telkom. An interesting comment to make. Of course, these retail price controls were introduced, I think, 14 years ago now at the time when Telkom was a monopoly. It was the indeed. Only provider of telecommunication services effectively in the country, apart from MTN and Vodacom, which still had to buy most of their services from Telkom. But that's changed dramatically, and she made the argument that maybe it's time to do away with these price controls. And maybe she has an argument to some extent, perhaps in the voice market there's an argument for that. I'd argue that in terms of the access network, they probably still have they do still have a monopoly over fixed lines. There is no other fixed line provider, especially into the residential market, so maybe there's an argument that retail price controls need to stay for basic line rental and ADSL line rental and that sort of thing,
at least until such time as there is genuine competition available.
But certainly in retail services, in the provision of bandwidth and in voice services, there's a strong argument. I think she's right. There shouldn't be price controls.
Sure. Yeah. I think that the market's moved far enough, and there is enough competition that they are perhaps not no longer necessary in those particular realms. But I suppose the problem too is, can they be? Well, I'm sure they can. Can they be split so that they only are only applicable to certain aspects of the business?
I'm sure they can. Sure they can. But right now, that basket of tariffs which they have to file to ICASA every year is is quite wide ranging. So I'd say in competitive markets, like, I mean, DSL bandwidth provision in the internet service provider space is hugely competitive.
Sure.
And Telkom is not the cheapest out there. Telkom internet is more expensive than if you go to a provider like MWeb or one of the others.
Sure.
So yeah, she probably has an argument there. But the other news happening this week, quite a significant development, was that IBM, the granddaddy of the computer industry, celebrated its 100th anniversary yesterday on Thursday.
Indeed, yeah.
You did quite an in-depth piece looking at the history of this company and its innovations and its fortunes and misfortunes. And
of course, over 100 years, there's a lot of both.
Yes. But some interesting company history. You tell us a little bit about some of the...
Some really interesting history. You know, aside from the fact that for any sort of technology-orientated company to survive 100 years is phenomenal,
yes,
and impressive in this day and age. You know, so many companies are up and gone in a generation.
Especially in the technology sector.
Yeah, absolutely. That. Firstly, I mean, IBM's history is just really, really interesting and really colorful. There's a lot of great personalities that have sort of had the helm over the years. One in particular was one family actually called Watson, and Watson Senior was the sort of CEO for about 42 years.
He was the first CEO, wasn't he?
And one of his sons then took over thereafter. But what was particularly interesting was the sheer number of things that we take for granted now that we actually have IBM to thank. You know, the barcodes in supermarkets, along with the scanners that make the checkers' lives that much easier and probably more boring at the same time. IBM was responsible for those. It was responsible for some of the machinery that has allowed for laser eye surgery. They created the floppy disk, which is one of those big black five and a quarter inch things for those who barely remember them. Essentially built the first laptop. Granted, it weighed 25 kilograms, but it was the first portable PC. Obviously, as most of our listeners will know, I'm sure they pioneered the home PC.
But missed that market in the end because they've really ceded it to Microsoft.
And this was one of the misfortunes that we spoke about. You know, after a while, they decided that it would be prudent to outsource the manufacture of components to people like Microsoft and Intel.
Yes.
And of course, Microsoft and Intel have now gone on to, for a while at least, virtually enjoyed the monopoly that could have and was once IBM's.
Yes.
They essentially sold all of the elements that made them a monopoly.
There's a great book I read a few years ago. I'm sure you can still get it on Amazon and elsewhere, called Big Blues, The Unmaking of IBM. Really, really fascinating read of how they got into trouble and the history and the negotiations with Microsoft around OS2, the development of OS2, and how Microsoft ended up going its own way with Windows NT, and really how IBM got into a world of hurt back in the 1980s and I think into the small part of the 1990s, and how they brought in Lou Gerstner from RJR Nabisco, which I think makes biscuits, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
And he really saved them. He came in and he changed the culture of the organization and really shook things up and changed its business focus away from being this big hardware, big tin company and turning it into a services company. Hugely successful and carried forward by his successor, Samuel Palmisano. And IBM, a couple of weeks ago, overtook Microsoft in terms of market value for the first time in something like 15 years.
Yeah, it's an amazing turnaround. But they've just also, you know, if you read through the history, there seem to have been a handful of moments where essentially someone wagered the entire firm on one or other idea.
Yes.
And had things gone the other way, IBM would be no more.
Yeah.
And one of the other funny things was during the Depression in the 30s, I mean, at the end of the 20s and the beginning of the 30s, IBM was one of the few companies who actually spent more money on employees.
Yes.
And again, it paid off because
they actually hired through that period, yeah.
Yeah. And then when the Second World War rolled around, they were one of the... They were sort of the preferred provider for the government's, all of the government's inventory taking equipment and so on.
Yes.
And they ended up landing, you know, arguably one of the biggest contracts of World War II, which was to do all of the data management for the US Army.
Great, great. Well, anyone interested in that history, Craig's piece is up on Tech Central. So go take a read of that. And at that point, I think we need to take a quick commercial break.
The Vox Superphone and your ADSL line go together like taxis and rush hour. Ah! But we do give a hoot. Now you can use your ADSL for more than just surfing. With the Superphone, you can call any phone, anywhere, using your ADSL line. You save money, earn rebates, and Vox to Vox calls are free. No contracts, just plug and play. Your ADSL and the Vox Superphone. It's the perfect combination. Make the most of your ADSL. Visit voxsuperphone.co.za.
After the advent of the telephone, it took mankind 70 years to invent the color television. And yet, it only took the next 23 years to invent lasers, the internet, to put a man on the moon. Ignition sequence start. It begs the question, what will the business world be like in the next 23 years? Wherever your business is at, Telkom Business will be there with you. Telkom Business.
Virtual Access, ECN's latest cost-saving telecom service. Virtual Access is a single 0860 number, providing your customers with national access to your company, no matter how many branches you have or where your customers are calling from. If you are currently using or plan to use an 0860 number, you need to talk to ECN. Virtual Access is the best price single national number offering in the market. For more, visit ecntelecoms.com. ECN. Lowering the cost of doing business.
Welcome back to Talk Central, the business technology podcast brought to you by the editors at techcentral.co.za. My name is Duncan McLeod. I'm here with Craig Wilson. So interesting news this week was the rebranding of Take-Two, which I use quite a lot, take2.co.za, which is one of the bigger local e-commerce providers. They sell books, music, movies, DVDs, games, that sort of thing. Always been a fan of them.
And some of it hard to get to, don't they?
Yeah. They take about 2 weeks to source stuff, but it's a great place to find music, for example. You can find you'll wait a couple of weeks, but you can get the stuff. But they rebranded this week quite controversially. Their new name is Take A Lot. I know a lot of people are quite unhappy with the name, but they're talking it up. Kim Reed, who's a former Nuspash executive, former CEO of MWeb, has taken over as CEO and bought 15%, I think around about 15% stake in the company, along with a big US hedge fund called Tiger Global Management. And they're talking about building this company into a 1 billion rand a year revenue company and really taking the fight to their biggest rival, Kalahari.net, which is owned by Nuspash. And going to be interesting. Kim Reed was saying to me over coffee that, in terms of volume of overall retail sales, it's still relatively small in South Africa, 2 billion out of the total, 561 billion. Whereas in the US, and I couldn't believe this figure, 8% of all retail sales in the US are done online.
I've read something similar recently and was equally gobsmacked.
That's extraordinary. Yeah, and if a similar, I mean, I don't think we're going to get to US levels just because of our internet penetration rates, but it certainly suggests that there's a lot of room for growth in e-retail in South Africa.
Sure, and I think I saw a graph this week that suggested that that increase, even to a mere, say, 2 billion.
Yes.
Just if you looked at it, plotted it, the increase in the last 2 years is enormous, exponential growth.
Mm.
I think people are warming to the idea. I think a lot of people were reluctant to buy online in the early days, but increasingly with the sort of checks and measures in place, it's just so convenient. I keep seeing more and more of the supermarket chains' delivery trucks. I keep passing more of them on the road. People seem to be happy to buy groceries online.
I've seen quite a few of those pick and pay ones around lately.
Yes, those are the ones I'm thinking of, yeah.
Mm.
So I suppose the consumer confidence has grown in it, and it is just so convenient.
I was actually up at the Pick and Pay Hyper here the other day, and I was shopping, and then there was a guy who came past in a shirt saying, so I can't remember exactly what it said, but something said like Pick and Pay e-shopper. Uh-huh. And he was shopping for someone.
Oh, for someone else.
Yes.
What a nice idea. It's like those guys who stand in the passport queues.
Yeah.
Only arguably more useful because as passport queues, you just end up paying double.
Yes.
Anyway.
For a piece of paper, at least you get the food this way.
Yes.
Have you ever bought groceries or anything online?
I've bought all sorts of strange things online. I've bought shoes, which is a risky one because you're not going to know if they're going to fit.
Yeah.
I haven't bought groceries, actually, no. But I've bought all sorts of consumer goods, especially electronics and things that you can't find, you can't always find here, or they're not stocked. One of my favorites was a Wacom pad and pen, because they're quite tricky to come by here, and they're an awful lot cheaper if you buy them overseas.
Oh, right, okay.
So, I'm certainly no stranger to it. I'm quite a fan of e-commerce. There are some things I'd be reluctant to buy, of course, like a suit.
Yes, yes. All right, so Craig, BlackBerry, or Research in Motion rather, published a rather disappointing set of results this week, sending their share price down 15%. And I see you watching Twitter and other social media feeds that the sort of sentiment seems to have turned against the company, and suggestions now that they could be the next Palm or the next Nokia.
Absolutely. I was going to say it seems to have turned entirely, with a lot of people predicting RIM's imminent demise, it seems.
Yeah, I think that might be an exaggeration, but certainly they are facing a number of challenges. They're getting some products to market late. There's been quite a bit of skepticism around the playbook, although you played with it this week and you quite enjoyed it.
Sure, but I read a comment today that I thought quite summed it up. I think the playbook, hardware-wise, is exceptional. It's a really excellent product. But there are just problems, particularly for those who are looking for a tablet. Mm. The first is the marketplace. Because it's a proprietary one, it's empty. I mean, compared to the Android and the Apple app stores, there's just so little available. And that's a major impediment, I imagine, if you're a tablet buyer. And the other problem is that at the moment, I believe to be corrected with a software update, but for the time being, there's still no native email client on the playbook. And of course, from a company who made their name on the back of email, that's particularly peculiar. In fairness, I understand why they've done it. They've done it from a security point of view, because another selling point of the BlackBerrys has always been their enterprise, their ability to go tie in with companies, you know, enterprise servers and so on.
Yeah.
And so it's a security feature, because as soon as your actual BlackBerry is untethered via Bluetooth to your BlackBerry playbook, all of your email and all of your details sort of disappear.
Yes.
So nothing's actually stored on the playbook. So the lack of a native client is a security decision until they've actually worked out software that is suitably secure and that they feel will mitigate that problem. But yeah, I can understand it. It's a lovely piece of hardware and it's really a pleasure to use. But if I were buying one, it just doesn't tick enough of the boxes.
But it kind of comes back to the Nokia story again, because Nokia makes really great hardware. I mean, I was playing around with the Nokia N8 the other day. Really fantastic phone, but let down by the software.
Sure. It's exactly.
So they're almost in the same boat. Certainly, I mean, not probably not on the BlackBerry phone side of things. I mean, they're working hard there, and a lot of people rave about the BlackBerry software, but on phones. But on the tablet, perhaps the parallels to be drawn with Nokia's reliance on Symbian.
The problem is, at the moment that the tablet is limited by the phones, and because it needs to be as secure as the phones, it's no better than them, which is fine on a phone, but is perhaps less acceptable on a tablet. I certainly found it so.
Yeah.
The other problem you said is there's a number of forthcoming BlackBerry products, but from a lot of what's been leaked, whether deliberately or not, consumers don't seem terribly excited about what BlackBerry are bringing. And in fairness, for so long, and particularly in this market, the benefits of BlackBerry have been the BlackBerry Internet Service and, of course, BlackBerry Messenger or BBM. But both of those seem set to disappear. You know, data's getting cheaper and cheaper. And in fairness, while always on access via BlackBerry Internet Services was great, it is painfully slow. Mm. And I think a lot of consumers, particularly the high-end users, would far rather pay for 3G and have the speed than wait for BlackBerry.
BlackBerry's done incredibly well in the South African market, especially in the consumer market, where you've found, especially, I mean, you go to one of the local high schools around here and you ask them, go walk around and do a snap poll, what phone are you using? 90% of them are using BlackBerries.
Yeah, and you can understand the appeal for, particularly for parents too. Yeah. If I had a teenager, I certainly would have gotten them a BlackBerry. It would save me a fortune.
Yeah, for sure.
But the problem is that that advantage is fading, particularly with things like WhatsApp. I mean, as you said, I think WhatsApp is the greatest threat to BBM at the moment because it's cross-platform.
Yeah, WhatsApp's fantastic. Yeah, I use it all the time.
And of course, Apple announced their iMessage coming in iOS 5, but I'm not particularly excited about that because that's only really useful to Apple users. It's these cross-platform options like WhatsApp that are really signaling trouble for BlackBerry.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. Almost time to wrap it up this week, but Craig, I wanted to ask you a little bit about Bitcoin, which is this, what do you call it, a virtual currency? Or
They call it a decentralized peer-to-peer currency.
What is it exactly?
Well, now you see, didn't you say you wanted to wrap up? That's a terribly long talk. I've been spending the last couple of days trying to wrap my brain around what exactly it is. Essentially, Bitcoin is a currency in the sense that you know it, except that there isn't any actual printed money. There is no central controlling authority like you'd have like we have our Reserve Bank, or the United States has their Federal Reserve. Instead, they've sort of plotted they've planned to only release 21 million of these bitcoins, which are currently trading at about $16 to one bitcoin, but that fluctuates wildly.
So I was looking at the graph, massive fluctuations
on any given day. Yeah,
looks like the Rand back in 2000 or so.
Yeah, it's mad. But essentially, the whole system is secured by this peer-to-peer network. So every transaction is traced and every transaction is recorded, albeit anonymously. There's no pointer necessarily to directly who made the transaction. But the idea is that by tracking them, they can make sure that you can't use Bitcoins twice, you can't counterfeit them, you can't duplicate them. And all of this encryption that takes place requires rather a lot of computing power. So Bitcoin sort of farms out the processing of these algorithms to users' computers, specifically, interestingly, to their graphics cards rather than their CPUs, because graphics cards are supposedly far better designed to handle the kinds of calculations that this Bitcoin encryption requires. And in exchange for offering up parts of their processing power, users are then rewarded with blocks of bitcoins that are assigned by the system. But it gets very complicated and intricate beyond that. And I read a story today talking about someone who's actually lost some of their bitcoins. We're not quite sure whether it was through their own sort of fault or negligence, or whether it was a malicious attack.
Well, I see there's a headline. Someone's just posted in our comment section. I see there's a headline on Ars Technica this afternoon saying new malware steals your bitcoins.
Right. So this is one of the challenges.
And you had an interesting chat with Mike Schussler, the economist, this afternoon as well. And he said one of the only way that currencies can work is if people trust them.
Sure. So. And that's the big obstacle here is, also, as I said in the same article, was it's terribly complicated at the moment. I've literally spent 2 days reading about, a little bit more probably, reading about Bitcoin and trying to wrap my brain around it. And, I'm at least a vaguely technical user, but the process of actually mining them and so on remains somewhat difficult to penetrate. But, I understand the basics. And there was a similar problem with file sharing back in the day. In the early days, it was easy to do if you were a high-end tech user, but quite difficult if you weren't. And I think we'll have to see how Bitcoin develops. If it becomes more user-friendly, that may help the uptake. But at the moment, a lot of people are calling it just sort of currency for anarchists and super geeks.
Yeah.
And in fairness, it does feel like it's sort of positioned that way, because it's the accessibility, it's really difficult to get involved and get to grips with it. And I think until that user experience improves, that it won't necessarily take up. But of course, the reason people are so excited about it is particularly this decentralized notion, and the notion that you could transfer money, from any country to any country. You can send it to any user with a Bitcoin wallet number, and there are absolutely fractional charges involved in any transaction. And obviously, the government doesn't know you're doing it, so you can't get taxed on Bitcoin money. I think people find
it. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, that's it. I'm not sure it's a good thing. I'm not sure whether it's an entirely good thing either. Also,
it sounds like it might just fuel an illicit underground economy.
Sure.
In trade in illegal substances and goods and services.
Which is also something a lot of sci-fi writers have speculated about, is just actually the black market currencies themselves and how they can take over when there is no regulation, how difficult it becomes. And then the sort of have-not gap becomes an entirely different kettle of fish, because it comes about sort of access to the information on how you manipulate the system. But it is certainly an interesting, I think it's a really intriguing idea.
Certainly.
And it's certainly worth watching. It'll definitely shake things up a bit. But can you imagine how quickly it'll get shut down if it does take off and governments suddenly realize, well, we're going to lose a fortune in tax.
If governments can shut it down.
Well, that's the problem too. And I suppose that's the idea, is that they're, you know, it's very sort of hacktivist based. And
yes,
by being peer-to-peer, the idea is that you can't shut it down.
Yeah, certainly no one's been able to shut down BitTorrent. So.
No, or the Pirate Bay, which is still up and running despite every attempt possible
and
to
WikiLeaks.
Get it down.
Same sort of concept, I guess.
Exactly. In fact, I believe I read something, but I didn't have it confirmed, that the sort of people behind WikiLeaks were at least somehow involved in the start of this Bitcoin.
Okay. All right, Craig, I think we're going to leave it there. The sun is going down and it's getting colder, so let's get this podcast up and get ready for the weekend.
Yeah, oh, I look forward to it.
It's been it wasn't for today, it would have been a four-day weekend, but
that's all right.
Some of us have to work, keep the economy going.
Yeah, it's quite ticking over.
Cool. Great. Well, as always, if you've got any feedback on the show, you can email us at info@techcentral.co.za. From Craig and myself, Duncan, until next week. Cheers.